Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Jay Leeming. Leeming's poems have appeared in many literary journals, including Plowshares, Black Warrior Review, and Poetry East. He's the author of a collection of poetry called Dynamite on a China Plate. It was published in 2006 by Backwaters Press. Leeming also received a poetry fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, and he is currently poet laureate of Tompkins County here in central New York. Welcome to the show, Jay.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Now, I know you're also a singer and a musician, so tell us, did you discover poetry via music?
Well, I wrote from a young age. I wrote poetry. But at a certain time, I decided to really focus on music and songwriting. So I did that for years in Minneapolis, played in many sort of failed bands, you know, failed rock star. But I really enjoyed the songwriting. And that, in looking back, that was excellent training for writing poetry, because I had to write words to be sung and pay attention to their sound, you know. Mm-hmm. That's great education for a poet.
Oh, yeah, I would imagine so. Well, obviously poetry and songwriting are in many ways different languages. So what was the pull of poetry instead of pursuing songwriting for you?
Oh, let's see. I think for me, I didn't have to pull any big amps up any stairs or move drums at 2 in the morning in Minnesota at the back of a cold bar, you know. I think for me, I found it easier to be honest in a poem. You know, this isn't true for everybody, but for me, it was true that being on stage with a spotlight and playing rock and roll, which can be music for adults, but there's a lot of forces keeping it a music for kids. Uh-huh. And for me, I found it easier to go deeper in poetry and to have less of a persona. So that's just how it worked for me. And as I got older, you know, it just happened naturally pretty much.
Uh-huh. And with poetry, you also have to pull music from the words.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It's probably in some ways more of a challenge.
Well, yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, they're different. They're related, but different arts. You know, a song, you have to fit the melody, you know, which can be just very frustrating, a lot of hard work. You know, every song has a different melody you have to fit words to. Poetry, at least in free verse, you're pretty free, you know, as it says. Uh-huh. Songwriting, it's almost like writing a sonnet every time, you know, that, like, fits a particular scheme, you know.
Yeah. Have you always written free verse? Have you ever tried to write rhymes? Other genres have you gone into?
I've done some schooling, you know. I've spent a while, you know, I've written a bunch of sonnets and stuff. It's just sort of a good education, you know. But the ones that tend to make it out into the world tend to be free verse on the whole. Not entirely, but...
Yeah. I think that you probably can be more honest with that, too. You don't have to worry so much about the rhyme.
Yeah, for me, again, you know, I mean, there's plenty of exceptions to these sort of, these aren't rules, but just as my experience, I found it easier to get at the truth of what I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one summer I was in a Shakespeare play here in Ithaca, and I wrote a bunch of villanelles, and some of them worked out, just because I was speaking in meter.
Tell people what villanelle is.
Well, a villanelle is a form that comes to us from the troubadours. It's kind of a complicated poetic form. It's like Dylan Thomas wrote, "Do not go gently into that good night." That's mm-hmm. that's a villanelle. So there's two lines which repeat all the time, and it's sort of like, as long as you can think of two good lines, you've got most of the poem written, but you have to make the rest work, you know. So that's the exception, but I did manage to pull off a few.
Well, I think that's great to be inspired by Shakespeare.
Yeah, well, you know, you gotta go to school with the greats, I guess, you know. So.
Now, much of your work touches on social and political issues, war, cruelty. Your work has the flavor of a dissident in it. Do you feel like someone who's an outsider in your own culture, or how do you feel about that?
That's a good question, isn't it? I think yes is the short answer, you know. A lot of us feel that way, I suppose. But in college, I was very politically involved, first with Amnesty International, and then I worked for Greenpeace for a year and a half after college, knocking on doors in the suburbs of the Twin Cities of Minnesota. And I think we live in a culture which doesn't pay you for works of the imagination too well. I mean, nobody's encouraged to go into poetry because it's going to make them rich and famous.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you labor in the direction of anything creative or imaginative, it places you in a different relation to the society, I think.
It's a way to do gentle protest. I remember Joan Baez used to say that. This mm-hmm. is the most gentle protest song that I know, and she would sing some of the old folk songs.
Poetry is a very intimate art, you know, it's something spoken and people hear it, they kind of hear it in their own bodies. So it's a way of altering the universe in a very fundamental way. Sometimes we want it, we wish we could write a poem and it would, like, construct a new park for us, or, like, solve a big, you know, problem of climate change, but its changes are more subtle and in some ways more long-lasting.
Yeah, poetry through the centuries has changed the world in many ways. going back to that, the idea of dissidence, some of the Russian poem poets. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now tell us about the evolution of your book, Dynamite on a China Plate. Now, I mean, that in itself is a poetry line. Tell us where the title came from, too.
It's from a line in a poem, and I felt it sounded good. You know, it's got some rhyme, Dinah, Anna, and China, you know. And it's a first book, so I figured, you know, it's good to begin with sort of a bang. You don't want to call it, like, moldy towels in the basement or something, you know. So I felt good about the image and felt it worked well.
Uh-huh. When I first saw that title, I was thinking that it would be a blast at me, you know, that your poetry would, you know, almost like slug me gently.
Yeah.
It sounds political to me.
Yeah, yeah. These images sort of arrive, and it's all analysis, even my own, is sort of after the fact, like picking up the pieces. But it's true, the China plate is in there as well as the dynamite, you know. I mean, I like to connect with people. I mean, that's part of what draws me to the poetry more than the music, because I found it easier to connect through words in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, to tell us how the book came about, was this a collection of poems that you'd written for many, many years and put together in a book quickly, or was it an evolution? Tell us.
It was an evolution, you know. I think when you're working on your first book, you just kind of grab every greatest hit you've ever had and try and make it work, you know. So they're written over many years, really. Uh-huh. And it's really interesting to put a book together like that and see what you've done and if any of it's any good, you know. So it just happened organically, revised many times, and started sending it out, and eventually somebody said yes, so...
I hear that you won a contest, and that's how it got published. Tell us about that. That's amazing.
Well, it's how a lot of things happen in the poetry world these days, you know. And there's a lot of poets lying around in some ways, and presses just have contests, and whoever wins, you get publication. So
you were the winner that time. What a shock that must have been.
Yeah, it was.
Because you must be like so many poets. You must send stuff out for years and get drawers full of rejections.
Well, it's encouraging to have that connection with the world. I mean, you talked about being a sort of a dissident or something. And for me, that's been the journey, is sort of having these kind of wild thoughts. And then the first step is actually honor them myself by writing them down. Mm-hmm. And then to give a reading is in some way to be healed, because you're bringing something back to the village from the wilderness. You know, and that's a wonderful thing. You realize that in walking away from established ways of thinking, you're able to find something which is of value to the community. So that's a wonderful feeling.
I've heard a lot of writers say that the writing itself has been healing for them. So you're sharing the healing process with the universe. It's a powerful image.
Yeah, well, it's been my experience, and I'm grateful for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want you to read a poem from Dynamite on a China Plate, and this one's called Supermarket Historian. Tell us a little bit about it.
I wrote this back in Minnesota, actually, working at a restaurant where I would frequently be a cashier. This, again, is one of those kind of ideas that your normal everyday mind throws away and is like, oh, that's silly, don't write that down. But then if you actually decide to do it and follow it, you get to something kind of juicy. So,
yeah, this is fascinating.
Yeah. So here's the poem. It's called Supermarket Historians. All historians should be supermarket cashiers. Imagine what we'd learn. Your total comes to 1066, and that's the year the Normans invaded Britain. Or, that'll be 1861, the year the Civil War began. Now all my receipts are beaches where six-year-olds find bullets in the sand. My tomatoes add up to Hiroshima. And if I'd bought one more carton of milk, the cashier would be discussing the Battle of the Bulge and not the Peloponnesian War. But I'm tired of buying soup cans full of burning villages, tired of hearing the shouts of Marines storming beaches in the bread aisle. I want to live in a house carved into a seed inside a watermelon, to look up at the red sky as shopping carts roll through the aisles like distant thunder.
Great. That's great. In many ways, you make the political personal, you know, the opposite of what people say, that the personal is political. That's interesting to me.
Well, it's another poem, too, that could have turned into an essay, and I had a hard time ending it, you know.
Uh-huh.
But poems are like dreams in many ways. They speak through images, you know. Halfway through, you want to start pontificating about food and foreign policy, but it's kind of better just to ride the images and getting to that wonderful house and the watermelon.
It's great to be subtle and be able to use a weapon.
I suppose,
that's exactly what poetry is to me often.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what prompted that poem? Was it something that you heard on the news, or how did that begin?
There was just the experience of being a cashier and, like, having that thought, you know, getting totals on the register and thinking, oh, that's a date in history, you know.
Oh, so it was just the cashier job. I was thinking maybe the cashier job and then you'd gone home and read the paper and connected the two.
Yeah. Well, certainly I was aware of things going on in the world at the time and linking the two.
Uh-huh. Is it your intention or mission to provoke, do you think?
I wouldn't say so. Maybe I aspire to that at times, but who wouldn't want to provoke, really, you know? I mean, part of writing poetry is not to have too much of a mission, because the mission can be suspect sometimes. But it's also to be true to what arrives to me, you know, what sort of creative ideas or images come, to follow their direction. So missions are great things. But in poetry, if you're a little too willful, that can be a little dangerous. It's better to submit yourself to what is happening rather than to try to force it into something.
Uh-huh. I've heard other writers say that. That's an interesting way of developing the idea of poetry.
Not
to force it.
Well, it's also like a carpenter respecting his materials or a sailor in a boat, you know. You can't just decide. You have to respect the ocean, you know. You have to respect the language and the images that arrive to you.
So with that in mind, are you one of those writers who encourages yourself as well as other people to write every day? And whatever comes, you know, you can always discard it or change.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, certainly that helps. I mean, we all have these big editors in our heads sometimes. I do anyway, you know, that says, that's no good, this isn't so great. And it's great to find a way to foil that and get back to the feeling of play, which is really where a lot of great things happen. I spent a year writing a poem every morning, just right away, which is great because there's no way you can write a good poem every day. Mm-hmm. So you just write something. Like, your standards go way down, and you're just like, I'm going to call it a poem, whatever it is, you know. And that was a great experience, and I actually did get poems that have worked quite well out of that experience.
I can imagine just letting it flow, as they say, would probably bring up quite a few good lines unexpectedly.
Yeah, turn on all the faucets you can, and then later on you clean up the mess, hopefully. Uh-huh. So
Jay Leeming, instead of having the smoke when he wakes up, writes a poem.
Well, not every day, but on many days, yes.
Now, tell us about your writing process. I understand from an interview that I read that you still take pen to paper. And you don't start at the computer like so many writers do?
Well, pretty much. There are some things that have started on the computer, you know. But mostly, the paper, it takes just a little more energy. And so you have to want to write it a little more, you know. I mean, I revise on the computer because you can cut and paste very easily, especially something's long. But just for me, it works better. I get the feel of the words better if I'm actually writing on paper.
Yeah, so. I feel the same way. I have a hard time connecting with my own humanness or something when I'm just working on a machine.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I need that organic feel of...
Mm-hmm. Also, the fonts of a computer are public fonts. Right away, you're in whatever, Garamond or Times New Roman, you know, and it's the same print as a lot of other people, whereas your handwriting is personal to you, and so there's a sense that it's still in your realm. It almost becomes too public too quickly for me. If I'm writing on a laptop, I'm already thinking about how the audience is going to react and who's going to publish it, you know, and that thinking can really kind of derail the process sometimes.
That would be a way to force yourself into a terror, thinking about who's going to publish it.
I suppose, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Jay Leeming. Now, do you think most poetry comes from the unconscious?
Well, where does poetry come from? That's the big question, right? You know, and if we could locate it on a map, we'd all go there, and there'd be a fountain, and we'd pay our money, and we'd get it. It's certainly an enterprise which involves the unconscious a lot, you know. So paying attention to dreams is a good way to go if you're going to write poetry. But it involves the conscious as well. I mean, hopefully it involves the whole kit and caboodle, you know, and the fingernails on your left hand, and your toenails, and your elbow. But, yeah, it's a balance for me between the unconscious and letting things sort of come up, right brain and left brain, you might say, and being sort of receptive to those things, but then also of sitting down and revising, you know, and actually working with the words on the page and deciding what you want it to mean. I mean, so it's a balance between those two things.
Yeah, I would assume so. Now, I want you to read another piece from Dynamite on a China Plate. This one I find really haunting. It's called I Want to Go Back. Mm-hmm. Can you read that for us and tell us just a bit about it before you do?
Yeah. Well, this is one of the older poems in the book. It's a summertime poem from a long time ago, actually. And yeah, I was living in Minnesota at the time. This is upstate Minnesota at a summer camp, a German camp, actually, is where some of these experiences happen. A German summer camp where you would learn German language. So I want to go back. I want to go back beyond the chicken bones and the piled garbage bags of Brooklyn in August. Back beyond the ring on her finger and the party years ago where I met her fierce, unpleasant husband for the first time. Back beyond even the warm confusion of her long body and blonde hair on the bare mattress of a Saturday. Back to the moment when we lay down sweating in the cricket-heavy darkness, with our heads together and the music of the dance we'd left burning just out of reach behind the trees, to when we did nothing but breathe as the northern lights loosened their vapors across the stars.
Oh, that's a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mm. You talk about having lived in Minneapolis and so on. Do you find yourself writing differently depending on where you are on the globe?
Yeah, I mean, again, that's something I perhaps aspire to be rooted in the place in such a way that the landscape really affects me. I lived in New York City for a while, and that was definitely a different energy. My poems were sort of quicker and a little wilder, but a little more fearful as well, you know?
I can imagine.
Yeah, my heart was a little more closed, and my my head and my imagination were working furiously. There's a lot of intensity in New York, of course. In the Midwest, I felt a little more open. It's good for me to be around nature, trees. And
I was going to say, what has affected you about living in this area?
Well, I grew up here, so...
I didn't know you had grown up here.
Yeah, imagine that. Crazy, yeah. So I grew up here, you know, Ithaca High School, whole thing. Was away for about 15 years total. Mm-hmm. Minnesota, New York City, and Vermont, and a year in Europe, actually. And then came back. So Ithaca, to me, is a great place to be, and the nature helps me a lot, you know. I mean, trees are generally comfortable with who they are and just go about doing their thing, you know. And... it helps me to be around that.
Mm-hmm. And when you travel, do you find that you aren't really home until you can start writing?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, sometimes, yeah, writing certainly helps. If I feel it's you know, a good place to let my imagination run loose, you know, that's always a good feeling.
I want to ask you this, too. Let's go back to the fact that you were a musician and you did play in some bands. Hmm. What was the different experience in regard to performing as a musician and performing as a poet? Do you have a different pull going on?
A different pull for me? You mean what's driving me to do it?
As the artist.
Yeah. I think, again, it's easier for me to connect with people through the words. There's less sort of paraphernalia in the way, you know.
So you found the instruments in the whole genre of rock and roll or whatever it was, keeping people almost away from the intimacy?
Well, for me anyway, some distance between them, you know.
Uh-huh.
And music's another realm. Music is so wonderfully pure of what it is. It's a sound. It's something sort of physical you can feel. You know, it's terrific. So you lose that by going to words. Suddenly you're in the everyday realm in some way. But I enjoy very much reading the poems and making them live because they're as spoken things and not just things on the page.
Because
in many ways, the page is sort of the sheet music for what you hear.
That's right.
I enjoy doing that.
That's interesting to me. Before we run out of time, I know you want to read a new poem for us, and we're delighted that you're going to premiere it here, perhaps. It's called History. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about it.
History, well, I don't know what to say about it. It's a newer poem, and I guess as I get older, I'm looking for connection with the past, and this is a poem where imagination goes backwards instead of forwards. You know, sometimes we project into the future. This is more a projection into the past, I would say. History. It turns out that the first white man in North America wasn't Columbus. It was a Viking from Jorvik who left his mark on a boulder in Nova Scotia. And that even he was preceded by a Basque from Santiago who sailed here in 784. It turns out the Aztecs made it across the Atlantic in 500 BC, landing in England to worship Quetzalcoatl in the rain-shrouded moors of Devon. It turns out things are different, surprising, not like you thought. The Laplanders of Norway were in North Dakota in the year 204, bringing with them a gospel written in Sanskrit by Christ's twin brother. Zulu tribesmen voyaged to the North Pole long before the last ice age. They brought with them abacuses and bells made of stone, also small machines remarkably similar to lasers. It turns out the Declaration of Independence was originally written in Celtic by Duke Ellington and Mao Zedong, then translated into English by the Druids of Mexico. The Atlas in tatters, usual wisdom shredded, flummoxed, Muddy Waters, the secret author of the Tao Te Ching, Emily Dickinson, the first translator of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Boston Tea Party started by Confucius, the assassination of Kennedy accomplished by Merlin, the hydrogen bomb invented by the Mayans of Germany. And whose story is it you're going to believe? And what dream of fact is this from which you have yet to awake? And where do you come from, O thread in history's rug? O water drop far from the sea? O man or woman kept and caught, imprisoned in a story written by others, wandering through someone else's dream of the world?
That's great.
Thanks.
That's great. Why did you say Kennedy was assassinated by Merlin? That line fascinates me.
Yeah, really?
Do you still think it's a mystery?
And well, I was just throwing everything in the blender, you know. Who knows what this poem is about? I'm the last one to ask what it's about.
Let the audience decide.
But I mean, it was throwing everything in a blender and seeing how things change, you know, and our perceptions of other cultures and of the past and history especially are always changing based on things discovered or what the latest hype is, you know. So this is just sort of looking at that and playing with it and then going as far as possible, I guess, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seemed a way to surprise our expectations of what Merlin might be doing.
That's interesting to me, because Sherwood Anderson wrote a book called Mary, Queen of Scots, about Mary and Elizabeth, and he has Mary say a line, "All history is forged." Mm. So I thought that was quite interesting. I think it's probably true, but when I first read that, I thought it was a lie. History
yeah.
can't be forged.
Right.
You know, the truth.
Well, we want to get down to the one story that it is, but so often we live in a universe of many stories,
uh-huh,
you know.
Uh-huh. And they are ever evolving, mm-hmm. depending on the interpreter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Now, you teach at the Community School of Music and Arts. Tell us what kids are looking for from a poetry teacher.
Well, let's see. Again, with kids especially, I like to clue into their sense of play and teach them that words are something that can be fun and can be changed and played around with, as opposed to something that just is on a no parking sign or a text form, uh-huh. or something you use. I mean, they say, you know, poetry is to prose as dancing is to walking,
mm.
you know, so I found that pretty useful. That was a guy wearing an American flag jacket in a bar in St. Paul, Minnesota, who told me that, actually. So that's pretty useful. I mean, you use prose if you want to get somewhere, if you want to explain how to work the DVD player. But poetry is a little more roundabout. And mm-hmm. so in working with kids, I like to encourage that and show them that that's possible.
Yeah, children's poetry is fascinating. Aren't you fascinated by some of the stuff that they come up with?
Yeah.
It's really pure poetry in
mm-hmm.
some ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like they're painting, too. It's just these wild things that happen. They're bushes that aren't really pruned, but they're just wild in their, you know,
yeah.
the life-giving.
I often wish adults could keep that whole sense of not being so self-conscious and worrying about making sure it's perfect. And you know,
right.
That's why kids' art is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Now, you also work with seniors at Lifelong. Tell mm-hmm. us what the difference is. How do you deal with the seniors in a different way?
Well, with seniors, you have the experience happening through a life, and so you can do poetry more based on things they've been through, and you might get at a depth of emotion which isn't always there with third graders, you know, or is there in a different way, let's say.
I would think seniors would be more self-conscious, or maybe a little bit more closed off, unlike children who are, you know, a little bit more daring and open in some ways.
Yeah, perhaps there's a little more of a opening sort of to be done.
So how do you pull
adults.
Them out?
I guess in creating a safe space, a place where it's okay to fail and where perfection is just sort of a word we don't really use. I mean, that's how I work with myself. Well, my grandmother was a piano teacher, and I always liked the idea of just being able to improvise something on the piano. And it's like in jazz, you know, it's not something that has to be written in stone and kept forever. So I try to keep that atmosphere when I teach as well. Just try it and see what happens, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Allow people to dare. Is what I would think, whatever their age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, do you still perform as a musician? Do you still write songs? Will you ever go back to that?
I don't perform really so much. Now and then with friends, you know, I play music and stuff like that. It's a question of time, really. How many roads can you walk down, you know, at any given time? So.
But you don't find yourself sitting at the piano going, oh, I think this is going to be a song instead of a poem.
Yeah, not so much. I mean, I come up with melodies now and then, but the lyrical part of my brain is sort of working on the poems, and to write words for songs would be like a whole other project to take on, you know, a glorious one, but I'm not sure I got the time of the hours in the day for that.
Yeah,
you know,
I can understand that. Yeah. Now, we do still have a little bit of time left. I want you to read another poem from the book. This one's called Van Gogh, and it has a longer title. You can tell them what it is. So, tell us about this. This is a fascinating piece.
I was living in New York City and going to the Met quite frequently, and there it is. There's a painting there, which is on a board, I believe, and on one side is a portrait Van Gogh painted of himself, and on the other is a portrait of a woman peeling potatoes, and that half of the portrait is very dark, and the other side is very bright. So I was just sort of struck by that. They're on the same board, you know. Mm-hmm. So the title of this is Van Gogh, Self-Portrait with Straw Hat and Woman Peeling Potatoes. Those are the two paintings. With long looking into himself, he found a face that is a swirl of yellow and red spinning around the hungry, determined centers of his eyes. And behind that face, on the other side of the wooden board from which he stares, he painted a large peasant woman peeling potatoes by candlelight into a metal pail. Perhaps the storm and sunshine of his soul had her at its center. Perhaps when the unhappy, bandaged one went out to the cornfield with a pistol and a head full of jagged darkness, it was she who whispered, "No home, no home," as a potato fell into the pail like a lost shard of the moon.
That's great.
Thanks. I guess I just felt that dialogue between the inward, perhaps sadness of him, and then the outward face.
So many people were touched by Van Gogh. I'm amazed by it. He really has hit a chord through the centuries.
Remarkable painter.
Yeah, he was. Now, I understand that you do have a new book that you're working on. Is it coming out soon? And tell us a little bit about it. Have the poems evolved from this first one?
Yeah, I would say they have, actually. That's what I hope, anyway, but it seems like they have. Yeah, I've got a manuscript, and it's floating around out there on people's desks, and it comes back like a boomerang sometimes, and you send it out again, you know.
Does it have a title?
A bunch of different titles I'm working on. We'll see which one comes up in the lottery. I mean, time has passed, right? We all get older, so the poems, I would hope, are a little deeper in some way. You know, my father passed away in 2003. Mm. Things like that kind of affect what you're writing, and the exuberance is deepened in some way. So there's maybe a few more shadows, but there's joy in a different way, hopefully, too.
And then you probably are able to, you know, move through childhood and the memories now that a chapter has closed.
Yeah, as well. And it's also like writing the first book when that was done. It's sort of, you can let go of that part of yourself now as well and move on to the future. So,
Well, we are almost out of time. Can you give a contact information or a website or something people can get in touch?
Yeah, sure. I've got a website, and it's simply my name. So it's jayleeming, jayleeming.com. And there's some poems on there, and you can contact me that way. And I'm around doing readings and stuff like that, so.
That's great. Well, Jay Leeming, thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you well in the future. I can't wait for the new book to come out.
Thank you, Tish. It's great to be here.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.